It's always a little, if you want to stop at any time, just let me know. This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is March 22nd, the year 2002. I'm at the Wisconsin Foundation Building, and I'm conference room, and I'm here with Marion F. Brown, and we're going to talk about her work and the foundation's work in the Chancellor's Scholarship Program. Before we jump to the program, however, let's go back a little bit and set some of the set some of your background up. Talk just a little bit about your childhood, your early schooling, elementary, high school. Any teachers or people who might have influenced you in the course of your studies and the direction of your life?
I grew up in Los Angeles. And while a lot of people think of Los Angeles as this large urban center where you may not know your neighbors particularly well, we actually knew most of our neighbors. We were very involved with the church, and that's probably consistent with the way most people or many people grew up at that time. I mean, you had your parents, but you also had your neighbors who watched out for you. And while we might have thought of them as nosy busybodies, they were caring and concerned about most of the children on the block. So I grew up knowing our neighbors, went to an elementary school in the neighborhood, walking distance, had very good teachers, was fortunate to have very good teachers, enjoyed art, had fun with that. I can remember having my work exhibited at an early age, and I went on to major in design,
yeah.
But it exhibited even in elementary school. Started at a middle school in our neighborhood, and then when I was in middle school, or what we knew as junior high school, my family moved to another area of the city called Lamert Park. We were fortunate in that, again, we knew our neighbors, good schools, and met friends at the junior high school I attended there that I am still close to today. Mm. So I have friends that we've been lifelong friends and became a part of their family, and they became a part of ours. Not so much I'm thinking about how we grew up and our house being in many, by thought of as by many as sort of the center for the kids on the block. And mm-hmm. So there were five of us. So I have two brothers, two sisters. But we have many more at the house all the time because my mother at that time wasn't working and all the kids would gather in mm-hmm. our RV. Mm-hmm. Teachers there and in high school, very active, encouraged to be active by my parents.
Active in the sense of?
We were active in the church, active in the community, and active at school, participating in extracurricular mm-hmm. activities. I think that all of us attended all of the games of all of the brothers. My brother, you know, you had to go to everything.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
So my brother ran track, played football, did all this. So we would mm-hmm. go to his games. They'd come to our programs. You were encouraged to participate in programs. And my parents, bless their hearts, attended everything. My father was a glazer, and during my middle school, high school years, he was working for someone else, but also started his own business and eventually opened up his own glass company in Los Angeles. And
now, as a glazer, do they make glass?
They don't make it, they put it in.
It's a placement. Because uh-huh. there's an art form too of that,
right.
Blowing glass, and I've heard that them referred to sometimes as glazers as well.
He would put the glass in that door,
okay.
Or the glass you see in this building. He was both residential and commercial,
okay.
But he wouldn't make it. He'd cut it, he'd fit it. He would design glass, if you wanted glass shelving or an area in your home, and you wanted mirrored cabinets or something, he'd do that. So artistic talent in that way. My parents, my father and mother grew up in Arkansas, were born and raised mm-hmm. in Arkansas. My father in Louisiana and in Arkansas. My father didn't go to college. My mother went to college when I was in high school. My mother returned to school and finished college. Yeah. And but he went on to have his own business and to be the first black glazer, one of the first in construction in Los Angeles, and the first in the area of glazing to have his own business.
Have been very interesting.
It was very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting in the sense that I think growing up we didn't quite understand why it was important to get these midnight phone calls.
Uh-huh.
You know, Dad, you got to go on this job. But having a better understanding today of what that meant, because he did emergency
mm-hmm.
work
right.
too.
24-hour call.
24-hour call. Yeah. You start in business, you take every call you can get, right? What else?
So, you continued with your art throughout
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
In your artistic abilities, your father sounds like he did.
My
was
father
sort of an artistic...
did, and my father did, and my mother too. In that, hers probably more reflected in the clothing that she sewed.
Oh, okay.
And my grandmother sewed, and my grandmother worked on did quilting. Was a quilter, and they would make. She made her own patterns. My mother usually didn't make patterns, but she would make a lot of art clothes. And so, because they sewed, I learned to sew. All of us did. And then, because of my height, it was very difficult to find, say, pants or clothes
mm-hmm.
that I might want, because they weren't made for most things for taller people.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned to sew and create
That's
our own, and enjoy doing it. Went on at the group that of people we associated with are our friends. You know, if you think, how do you get to college? I think it was just an expectation my parents had of us.
Yeah.
And had of our friends, and our friends' families all shared the same expectation of the children. So now I understand how it works a little bit better than I did at the time. I mean, your parents try to control or manage your relationships to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
and they want you associating with people who are have like values.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Right, yeah. And so, I mean, I just didn't consciously think of it that way when I was growing
yeah.
up. But so we all, most of my friends went off to
Well, with your
college.
Mother going to school later on,
yes.
that's, my mother never had a chance to go to high school because
mm-hmm.
of the depression and everything, and she
mm-hmm.
did that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I couldn't figure out why anyone would want to go to school at that point, you know, I just
right.
wanted to get out.
Yeah.
But I think it certainly would instill that craving
mm-hmm.
for learning,
We had that, and then when I think about it, we used to, when the kids would come over from the neighborhood, my brothers and sisters would, and we'd play. I'd usually get to be I would be the teacher, and they would be my students.
Mm-hmm.
We'd set up little classrooms.
That's great.
Yeah.
It also sounds as if in both of the places you lived that there was a very strong sense of community.
Yes, there was.
Which is going to, we'll be talking about that later on with the Chancellor Scholarship
mm-hmm.
Program. So you certainly had a sense, an awareness of, and a sense of community
There was
at
a
that
very
point.
Strong sense of community, and my parents were volunteers.
Oh.
So volunteers in the sense that they would work
okay.
with, my father would be very involved with the NAACP or the Urban
mm-hmm.
League and with the church. My mother's very involved with the church and the Girl Scouts and PTA and that. So in her case, a lot
mm-hmm.
of the volunteer activity has to do with the children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in my father's case, it has to do with civic. And
sounds like they were very busy people.
They were very busy.
Going to school, raising children,
right.
volunteering,
yeah.
24 hours call for blazer
right.
activity.
I didn't think about it at the time.
Yeah, there I did. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What about career aspirations in these early years, up
mm-hmm.
through the end of high school? What were you thinking? Or were you?
I don't know if we thought. I don't think we thought much of, for instance, we never thought about not going to school because it was an expectation. It was always about where you would go, not if you would go to college. And with careers, we thought some about it, thought about teaching, and that's probably what I thought of the most. Thought about, enjoyed art, but didn't think of it as a career possibility just because, as my friend's father said, you have to eat, and how are you going
Isn't
to eat if you
yeah. Yeah.
if you do this, but often thought of teaching, but didn't know exactly what I would do. And see, I'm probably on that cusp of that. Yes, women are working. Women, no one's telling you that women can't work. Mm-hmm. But they weren't necessarily talking about all the different career options.
Right.
But they are talking about different options, so it's not only teaching. There are many more options, but people weren't talking about all of them in the sense that, in the same way they would talk to a young woman today about either
engineering, whatever you want to do, you just go and do it.
Right. Although my sister, one sister is a doctor, and one's been involved in politics for years. And brother's a writer.
Great. Really?
Yes, I'll tell him about this today.
UCLA. What led you to enroll at UCLA, besides the fact that, of course, that it was Los Angeles?
Good, very good school. And we were actually thinking, I wanted to go to a predominantly black school. But we couldn't afford that. Those were more expensive, and UCLA was the state school, very good school. Mm-hmm. And so my parents said, well, let's start at UCLA, and maybe we can move from there. And a number of my friends went to UCLA. Mm-hmm. And so enrolled at UCLA. And the other reason I thought predominantly black, that would be fun. And it would also be away from LA. But I'm glad I went to UCLA.
That's a wonderful school.
Yeah.
And you majored in art there.
I majored in art, yeah.
Was that a tough decision, or was that something that just kind of slid your way?
So it slid my way. I started taking art courses and enjoyed the art courses and the design courses, and to provide the backup my friend's father said I needed. I also did a degree in education. So I have so I have the teaching credential. An education degree, and then the undergraduate and graduate degrees
in art. And then you went on and you got an MA and an MFA.
An MFA, right.
And those, were they in art or design?
Design. Those were in design.
And what are you thinking about now for a career?
At that time, I'm thinking working possibly in fashion, some other area of design, and still thinking about teaching. Had a very good design professor who suggested that I think about teaching at the university level. That she thought that that it would be both an intriguing career and one that I might enjoy. I might be professionally and personally rewarding.
Hook up? Did you appreciate that? Did you take her advice or listen to her advice? Who was she?
She was a design professor. McCloskey was my advisor, and actually I cannot remember this woman's name. But she suggested, and she was. I didn't take classes from her. She was someone who knew of me. You know, it's a professor. Who took an interest in me, and she taught interior design. And I didn't take interior design courses, so we would just talk from time to time. And well, actually, at that time, probably every week we talk. And so, mentoring in a sense. And I didn't think of it as that at the time. Mm-hmm. But then a job at Wisconsin opened up, and quite frankly, I'd never heard of Wisconsin. And didn't know what a chill factor was.
A very cold place.
And she started really talking about Wisconsin and the Midwest and the design program, and suggested that I look at this and at least see whether or not I was interested. And my advisor, Mrs. McCloskey, suggested that it would be a great opportunity and just at least visit the university and see if I...
Now, this was after you had done, social work for a year? You were a social worker, and you had been a secondary teacher as well in Los Angeles. That was in... It was just for the record, you're 6970, you were a social worker.
I'm substitute teaching as a graduate. So I did my undergraduate degree, finished my undergraduate degree. As I tried to decide what I wanted to do next, I decided to do social work. I needed a job, right? I needed a job for the summertime, and I thought I could do social. So, and I had to pass the exam, and I passed the exam, so I could... I was a social worker for a year, and I also learned a lot more about people in Los Angeles, and had a feel for it. But I tell you, when you have someone that young going into social work and talking to people who have incredible issues they're trying to address.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they know the system better than the new social workers know the system.
Right. They know the system, and their experience base is so much different.
That's from right.
Oh, my
that's
goodness.
Right.
Yeah, that's a mismatch.
Yeah, they're running games on us, too, but you know that. and you drive into the neighborhood, because I was a social worker in South Central Los Angeles and in the West area, and the kids know, oh, the new social workers come. So did that for a year, and then returned to school, did the education degree. When I finished that, and I was still in graduate school, I was a substitute teacher that helped me to pay for graduate school too. I had some grants, but also needed additional.
Did you enjoy substitute teaching?
Some days.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed teaching. It was middle school and high school, but you know, substitute teachers are.
I did that for a year. I know exactly what you're talking about.
They're waiting for you to come.
Yeah. But sometimes you feel you're walking into some kind of a trap.
Exactly. They think, oh, the sub is here. It's like, oh, the new social worker's here. Well, oh, the sub is here. Yeah. They had fun with us.
Yeah.
But they were good kids. It's just, it did help me to recognize I probably did not want to teach
junior
high school. I wanted to teach, but not junior. Their hormones are flying off.
Yeah, that's just how I used to feel. You just you could just feel it in the air.
Yeah.
There's just this electricity. And there are some people, bless their souls, who love teaching middle school. They
love that
energy level. And I would have just gone crazy.
Oh, the energy. The boys, this is the changing of the dress code, right? I mean, so kids are starting to wear whatever they wanted to school. And so, it took me a while to figure out that these boys kept asking this girl to go over to this window and do something. Well, the girls have this dress that keeps hiking up, and she, you know, it's just wild. And then one day I remember closing the door and saying, look, we are going to have a, you know, it's just taking off the teacher hat and putting on the, we're going to work through this, and so, but it was fun.
Yeah, middle school was, I can remember those classes very well. I taught some shop middle school shop, and it became dangerous because there were chisels and saws and things
like
that, but you do manage to survive. Okay, so this call comes from Wisconsin. You come here for an interview in the school. Well, it was called?
School of Human Ecology.
It was Human Ecology then?
I think they were just changing from Home Economics to Human Ecology. So submitted my materials, received the call and invitation to come and to interview. Had never been to the Californians. Think of themselves. We think of ourselves as fairly worldly, but pretty parochial.
Yeah.
you live in California. Why do you want to go anywhere else? Why would you want to live anywhere else? Right? You have the desert. You have the ocean. You have everything right there. So I looked up Wisconsin on the map, did some reading, and then came here for the interview. Didn't know what to thought Midwest. I don't know what's in the Midwest, you know, and thinking really more like Montana or Wyoming or something. And get off the plane, and some very nice people meet me and take me to this restaurant for dinner, and I think, you know, and then to the hotel, over to the IVN.
Oh, the IVN, yes.
That's where they used to take all the candidates, I think, to the IVN. And interviewed and thought, well, this might be interesting to try for a year or two if it works out. And then I was offered the position and taught design. Mostly apparel and two-dimensional design for 7 years.
And you were here for 10 years in the department from about 72 to 82, wasn't it?
From about 72 to 82.
Did you, I seem to remember somebody telling me, or you telling me, or me reading that you created some courses as well?
We created some courses, some new courses. Also administered a new program they were getting going with the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York.
Yes, right.
And so I administered that program, which required me to work with students interested in going to New York, visit New York once a year, work with FIT and the people at FIT.
Ooh, that must have been fun.
It was great fun.
Yeah.
Great fun, yeah. And so would travel to New York and work with them usually once a year.
Did you enjoy working with the young people and teaching at the
college
level?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
And the school was very interesting at that point, too.
Mm-hmm.
You were starting to get more men enrolling, and
there
was a change.
There were a few more men enrolling. School was also interesting because, quite frankly, since I'm not there, I mean, it was going through a lot of turmoil at that time,
yeah.
too. So part of it is, I think, the change in the administration,
yeah.
being broken away from CALS. I think it's
That's
always
the College
been
of Agriculture and Life Sciences.
Life Sciences.
Right.
I think it was always a challenge for them to figure out who they were in some respects, because it is a fine example of what it means to be interdisciplinary. It's one of the best examples on campus, but that's always easier to talk about than it is to do. And so you have design professors, you have environment, textiles, and design. You have people focusing on children and the family.
Mm-hmm.
You have people focusing on communications, education, and taking the five various programs and making them into some type of integrated
mm-hmm.
unit
mm-hmm.
was something they were working
Boy, that's
through.
Really, yeah, that's really
mm-hmm.
difficult.
Yeah, and I think it was predominantly female in terms of the faculty. And student
what, did
as well.
That hurt it overall, like within CALS, I know that was before you
mm-hmm.
came, within CALS, the fact that this was sort of the female
mm-hmm.
dominated, was that a plus or a negative for them, or don't you really?
I wasn't around then, but I think, as is often the case, it's a plus when women are trying to, or any group that's different is trying to enter or make its way. It can be a plus to be around people like yourself. But politically, when you're trying to advance, it can be difficult.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
What's the plus is you're not necessarily competing with the nutrition, with the chemistry professor down the hall who didn't think you were competition
mm-hmm,
anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think they probably didn't have as many of the advantages as some of the other units on campus have.
Yeah.
I think they had to fight and scrap for everything.
Yeah.
And I think they did a pretty. There were some tough women.
There were some very tough women.
Yeah,
they were a very interesting group of people. I've interviewed several of them.
Mm-hmm.
Louise Young, who worked
sure.
for Extension and Home.
Right.
Gosh, they had these women who were going off to all parts of the state by themselves, by buses or trains or
That's
however
right.
they could get a ride
right.
to do this kind of stuff. Things that just really surprised
mm-hmm.
me a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Very tough, very accomplished women, in most cases single.
Yeah.
And I think that it probably took most of what they had to build the career, and it was hard to build a career
yeah.
and a family at
yeah.
the same time.
A very interesting group of people.
Mm-hmm.
So after you were there about 10 years, what happened at that point? How did the foundation come a knocking?
What I learned is that if you're talking about tenure, I didn't have a strong research focus. I didn't have a research focus at all. And my strength is the teaching piece of it, but not the research
mm-hmm.
piece of it.
And
mm-hmm.
wasn't this at a time when some schools, perhaps human ecology at this point, they were trying to build a stronger
right.
research base?
They're trying to build a stronger research base. They're trying to, so there's a transition taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And my credentials weren't going to be strong enough for
mm-hmm.
tenure. So given, you always get that, okay, you get another year, you can decide what do you want to do next? Do you want to go on and continue teaching somewhere else perhaps? Or do you want to go off into another direction? And what I ended up doing was working in this position with the Chancellor Scholarship Program. And this is after looking around. I mean, for a few months after leaving human ecology.
Oh, so you were gone. You were
mm-hmm.
gone from human ecology.
Right.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I left human ecology, and I'm trying to decide what I want to do next. So I'm doing my networking interview
mm-hmm.
and viewing and talking to people and doing some freelance work and just trying to figure out what the next step might
yeah.
be. And a friend told me about this position, and I thought, well, that might be that this new position was being created, this program which wasn't called the Chancellor Scholarship Program, didn't have a name at that time. And perhaps I might want to consider it, and they thought I'd be good at it. And this was Tom Schick, who mentioned it to me, who was a professor in Afroland mm-hmm. and is no longer with us.
Unfortunately, yeah. He yeah. died in a tragic, very tragic accident, mm-hmm. Probably about 1985.
Right,
like
right. Yeah. Right.
There is, by the way, for anyone listening, Tom Schick was interviewed by the Oral History Project, and his interview is on file.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Good, yes. Good friend of ours. He was the best man at our wedding.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So, I, all right, I didn't know much about development. Let me see what I can find out about development. And nobody knew much about the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over to the foundation offices and picked up some materials and didn't tell them why I was there, but picked up some materials.
Ah, that's great.
And spent some time in the library. We weren't doing much on the internet at that time, learning more about philanthropy and development.
Mm-hmm.
So I could talk about more than bake sales and
right.
what we used to do in the church. And then interviewed for the position. It was a group interview. And met some really, actually had fun. It was
actually,
a fun interview.
That interview sounded very interesting. I talked to Martha Taylor. She was there, right?
Uh-huh. Martha
and,
was there.
Could you name the people here? Tom Schick was there, wasn't
Tom
he?
Tom Schick, Martha Taylor, Joe Corey, Jim Churchill, Marcille Lee. Is that it? One other person, I think. But I think that's...
Roger close. Howard, perhaps?
Roger. Maybe yeah. Roger.
Yeah. And that's a very fun group, interesting
oh, fun,
group of people.
It was a
yeah.
fun group to interview yeah. you with, and I can remember them asking me to have a seat. Oh, why don't you sit in that comfortable chair over there? And I said, no, I don't think I want to get too comfortable. I want to be in it. And I want to be sharp for the interview, so I don't want to do it. And the whole, it was just a lot of fun.
Did you feel things starting to click in the interview?
It clicked very early on for me yeah. in the interview. It just I felt very comfortable with them. And
how did they describe the position at that point in time?
You know, they knew they wanted someone to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
The university had never been proactively sought support for scholarships because Wisconsin felt if you wanted to come in here, you'd come. And we had some scholarship support, but the foundation hadn't been raising money for scholarships.
Yeah, this was a new thing for them,
mm-hmm.
wasn't it?
We had some scholarship money. Some funds, but we hadn't gone out and sought support for scholarships. Didn't know whether or not we'd be able to generate support for minority scholarships, so it's scholarships, minority scholarships. Didn't quite know how the position would work.
Was the concept of need-based versus merit-based scholarships, was that addressed at that point?
It was merit-based scholarships, but I don't remember us going into great detail.
Okay.
But scholarships merit-based, and that the position would be housed both within the foundation and within the vice chancellor's office.
So it's really, is this like a 50-50?
50-50.
It's a percentage
right.
thing, you know, just in two places.
Thinking that the person in this position would have to know about the scholarship, so on the administrative side, you're helping to create the program and learning about how it fits into the university, and at the same time, you're generating the funding base. Excuse me. For the scholarship.
So you're, did you come away interested in this job?
Oh yeah, I did.
Did
I
you have
there.
A pretty good feeling that you were going to get it?
Well, I knew that, I thought it had gone well. Usually you know.
Right,
gone,
you sure do.
You,
yeah.
If you know if they're going well. So I thought it had gone pretty
yeah.
well. And I was interested in the position. And I thought that my background was a good fit for the position. The fact that I traveled to New York regularly
mm-hmm.
and had coordinated that program. There were some skills one would need that I thought I had. Plus, I believed in what they
mm-hmm.
wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Believed very strongly in what they wanted to do. And you always want to work for either an organization on behalf of something you believe in. And so, I thought I could work with the people in that room. And I think there was another finalist too, or semi-finalist. I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd also done a little homework, and that helped,
That's
too.
Right. And Martha Taylor was there representing the foundation.
Martha represented the foundation.
That's an interesting story in itself, that she would have been Why do you think she was chosen to represent the foundation?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Martha, the foundation was very small at that time.
Yeah. People can't realize that today, but it was very small.
Everyone could fit, maybe 10, 20 people at most. I don't even know if there were 20. And Martha was one of the vice presidents. Martha had helped to develop what was then called and still is, a constituency-focused program, meaning that the people in the foundation didn't raise money. When they started, everyone raised money for everything. And at that time, people were beginning to say, if I'm a graduate of a university, I'm a graduate of the university, but I relate more to L&F, or I relate more to engineering because the university had become so large. And so thinking that what we really want to do is hire people to raise money for the university, but you're working on behalf of engineering. Mm-hmm. You're working on behalf of L&F. So Martha helped to develop that concept and implement that program.
Was this a pretty new concept nationally
at that
in foundations?
Time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Relatively new at that time. So that, I think, had been in place a year or two. And so it was a natural...
So it was a natural step.
A good next step, I think. So Martha was a natural person to look at this. Plus, Martha believed in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Joe Corey knew Martha well, and Joe and Martha talked. And then Irv Shane knew Martha. Mm-hmm. Irv was the chancellor at that time. We still have been having conversations with Irv. And I think her real concept, her mentor and the person she worked most closely with on this was Bri Curl. And I think somehow Martha became the one, and I'm not sure how that happened. I think it happened through Irv talking to the foundation about wanting to do this and knowing Martha and bringing Martha into the picture. And Martha also believes in the Chancellor Scholarship Program.
Yeah, I believe Irv Shane was the one who picked Martha. As a matter of fact, based on my conversation with Martha, we agreed to have an interview about her role in this, in the Chancellor Scholarship Fund,
mm-hmm.
sometime this fall, perhaps.
Good.
Because there's an important little connection
mm-hmm.
right there, too.
Mm-hmm. Very important. Very important. Because they actually did solicit faculty, I believe, before I was hired. And Martha was involved in that. So I think a mailing or something went out to faculty to generate that initial basis support. So Martha was very involved in helping shape
mm-hmm.
the program and was part of the committee after established too.
Well, let's talk about the foundation for a few moments at that point in time, mm-hmm. and then we'll move over mm-hmm. to Mercile Lee
mm-hmm.
and to your work with her. Bob Rennebaum was the...
Bob Rennebaum was the president. Tim Riley was vice president, I think probably a senior vice president, but was probably the... No, Martha had the... Then Martha's tenure. Martha was the vice president. John Fell was involved, the vice president of finance, Fred Winding, and I think that was the management team.
That's a smaller table than this even that they could fit around.
Right.
What kind of support did you feel coming from that end of the?
Well, we also had some. I was hired the same day, April Fool's Day. I started the same day Walt Keough started, who worked with L&F.
Oh, okay.
And there was someone working on behalf of business. Walt was hired actually to work with engineering, that's right. So they were hiring people to work with the various...
So you're really at the base of this,
so
at the foundation of this whole new change, which must have been very interesting.
And most of them were second hires. So engineering had one person,
okay.
This was the second person.
Gotcha.
So still fairly new, Wisconsin Center. I think Walt and I shared a desk, and possibly with someone else. So you had a corner of a desk when you came over. It's all very new, very new.
And where were you located?
Wisconsin Center, top floor.
Top center. Okay.
Yeah, so we had those offices, that first office when you get off the elevator and go to the right. And so we've been in a couple of different offices.
Gotcha.
So we were in the Wisconsin Center. And Martha was responsible for bringing us
mm-hmm.
along and mentored us and
mm-hmm.
helped us to understand the expectations and the way in which we worked with the university. So that was Martha.
Well, Martha said to ask you a couple of questions. I always ask, do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
Sure.
And she talked a little bit about how she was really the first woman to be hired by the foundation.
That's right.
And you were the first black to be hired by the foundation
in
these executive positions. And she wanted me to ask you let me get the exact question here. What it was like to work at the foundation in those early years as a black. Did you face any barriers because of your race or your gender?
Mm-hmm.
And how were you, how did you deal with them?
I think to answer that, I'll just talk.
Okay.
I probably you'll have it. But within the foundation itself, I don't remember too many racial barriers. I'm sure there were some, but I don't
right.
They don't stand out. You know? And in part it's because people pretty much said, well, you know, we were all finding our way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
And Martha was very helpful in bringing us along and mentoring us, but we were still there weren't formal training programs in place. She had some plans or had put together the training program, but not in the sense that we function today, not in the same way. I think what you centers, foundations are very conservative organizations. Okay.
Yes.
The more you look like the person you're talking to, the more likely you are to be successful in raising money from that person. Because, you know, you develop that relationship.
Right. You have an immediate, yeah.
And it's not just looking like the person, it's probably sharing as much as possible so that what you're trying to do is create a sense of comfort with you. Okay. So when we're talking about people outside of the foundation or the donors, that's where I would get a stronger sense of a disconnect or you walk in the door and someone thinks, oh, you know, they're not expecting a 6-foot-tall black woman to walk in the door representing Wisconsin, you know, and then you put your heels on too. So I think there were challenges in terms of going out, but usually I didn't bring those back to the office. See, part of it is when you talk about being a black woman, by that time there weren't a lot of us doing any of the things that we were doing.
Yeah.
You know, so you get used to trying to figure out how to make it work, and when it gets particularly frustrating, you get together with your friends and you talk about it.
Did you have, well, that's an interesting concept. Did you have I know you were friends with Tom Schick and he was best man at your wedding and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a group of black, there weren't many blacks on campus
in
faculty positions and whatnot at that point. Did you pretty much have a network out there that an informal network that you worked with?
There was an informal network, and then some of the black faculty would get together at that time. Once I started working with the scholarship, Marcel and I became good friends, and so that network grew.
Mm-hmm.
But there were enough blacks on campus for you to be able to share some with each other, and then friends across the country. A lot of my friends were doing things that a lot of people weren't doing either. So you'd share some strategies.
That would make sense because so many changes are occurring in society. We have to throw this against the backdrop of society at this time for professional, for not only blacks, but for women, but as we mentioned earlier.
Right.
Doors are opening up that hadn't been opened before or didn't exist before.
Right. And so, and I don't mean to make light of it, it's just that you did what you had to do. And by that time, I'd also been teaching in a department that was all white, that had one black graduate student when I arrived, and she left to go on to teach down south. And I think that was probably more of a challenge even than the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And then Midwesterners also have some pretty narrow views sometimes, so you should figure out how to deal with those. Students were a challenge, because some of these students can be darn arrogant, you know, so they're arrogant anyway. And then you add to that the fact that this is a black professor standing up in front of them, so you're learning to deal with that challenge and finding strategies for coping with that. So it's not to say that they didn't exist. They were, and they and there are times it was very difficult. But I don't remember the foundation being a lot more difficult than the rest of the university.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it was such a changing world at the foundation. And what an exciting time to be here, in a sense, because things are, new ideas are perking along, these new, what do you call it, constituencies.
Constituencies are developing. So a lot of new things are a lot of things are happening, and I think that people were trying hard.
Yeah.
I think, and then Bob Rennebaum is just incredibly gracious, so I'm sure they were figuring out how to work with me at the same time I was figuring out how to work with them.
And then you had an office in the foundation. Did you also have an office on Baskin?
I had part of a desk.
You had the corner of a desk at the foundation.
And then I had an office in Baskin.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your hire. Where was Mercile's office in relation to yours?
We were both up on the third floor, I think, in Bascom, and she was a couple of doors or a door from me, and Peg Geisler was up there.
Oh, that's right. Peg was up there, too. Tell me a little bit about your early months with Mercile, learning about the program, learning about Mercile.
There wasn't a program to learn about.
Right,
at
well,
the, time,
the
we were putting
idea,
the program,
rather,
yeah,
right.
It was working through what the program might be, and there was a committee, and most of the people, if not all of the people on the search committee also were on the sort of this guided.
Is this the oversight committee?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
The initial oversight committee, and that committee's function was to pretty much lay the groundwork. So we set the criteria for the scholarship. Formalized the mission of the scholarship, the selection criteria, all of the administrative aspects of the scholarship were discussed, or the program was discussed with the committee.
And the committee is in part made up of the search committee,
right.
Joe, Corey,
right.
Roger Howard, I believe, was on it,
right.
Jim Churchill.
Right.
And then
right.
Was Wally?
Wally Dama.
Dama.
Wally was on the first selection committee. I don't know if he was
okay.
on the oversight committee.
So it's basically that same group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
I think Wally was on the search, might have been on the search committee. He was on the initial oversight committee, too.
Did anyone chair those meetings?
Yes, they were chaired. Was it Tom or Mercile? I'm not sure whether Mercile chaired them or someone else,
okay.
But Mercile played a very...
Yeah, I was going to... That's what I'm kind of moving toward. Mm-hmm. What kind of a role did Mercile and any of the others that you might recall, and yourself, what kind of role?
Very vocal. Very, very... I can't remember if she was the chair. That's interesting. I don't think she was the chair, but Mercile had very definite opinions about what she wanted this program to be. Okay, and how it would function, or what the selection criteria would be when compared to other programs on campus. And much of this had been worked out in her mind prior to the establishment of the program, through her conversations with Irv and her conversations with Fry, and looking around the campus and saying, you know, there's a hole here, there's a gap.
Mm-hmm.
That we're doing a very good job, or we're doing a good job when it comes to recruiting students with strong need or with some academic gaps, but we're not doing a good job when it comes to identifying and recruiting students, talented minority students.
Okay.
And so that was to be the focus.
Okay. It's interesting, when I first met Mercile,
mm-hmm.
she's a very soft-spoken person,
mm-hmm.
but you also learn very quickly that there's sort of a steel backbone
right.
there. That
absolutely.
You're not going to be, she's a very tough person.
Yes, she is.
Did she more or less lead the group in the direction of the, did the group buy into her vision?
The group bought in, and they had already bought the vision before they came to the table, and I think that, like with many things, they were at the table because they bought the vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there weren't many table people there who didn't agree with the concept.
Yeah.
Now, Wally, for instance, has very strong opinions about financial need.
Right.
He understood the role of the scholarship, and he was supportive. So you had someone at that table who, well, one is head of student financial aids at that time. So he was key to the work we were doing. But he also understood the importance of this scholarship, focusing on merit.
And I think that's something that we should emphasize, because up to that point, this just did not exist on
that's
this
right.
campus.
That's
so
right.
so you're talking about a major, major change
shift.
In financing
right.
scholarships
right.
for students.
That's right.
And this was, had there been any kind of a battle or anything? Not battle, that's too
mm-hmm.
strong a word. Had there been discussions before you came on about this, or was this?
There were discussions, and I think that Marcel had those conversations with Irvin, with Fry, probably to a limited extent with the financial aid mm-hmm. officer, with Wally, but I think they worked through.
But by the time you came on, there was pretty much
mm-hmm.
Consensus on
right.
that.
Right, right. Now, whenever you have limited resources, there are always going to be discussions about how much you move this way and how much you put in this pot over here. But part of that was dealt with through the because we were raising money for the scholarship. You see, so if we were able to raise enough money to support merit-based scholarships, then we had the program. But the university wasn't diverting money from
okay.
Wally's shop, from need-based initiatives to give to merit-based.
So what they're doing is they're making all these, I use this loosely, mm-hmm. kind of pie-in-the-sky recommendations,
mm-hmm.
and all the time there's Marion sitting at the end of the table, and it's going to fall on her shoulders, in
we'll
a sense, and the foundation, to see if it can actually
be done.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone had great confidence that it could be done.
Oh,
that we'll try it.
This was an experiment.
It was an experiment, and I was hired as part of the experiment. I mean, I wasn't hired with the thought that I would be here for years doing this. It was in part, let's see how this goes.
Now, you had, what, a three-year, how did that operate? Explain that.
Hired to do this for 3 years, let's see if it's going to work. But at the end of the second year, things were working well with the foundation. And the decision was made that I'd go 100% foundation.
Right. Before going mm-hmm. further, you said 3 years to see if it would work.
The it
meaning raising enough
money
to
right.
support the program.
Right.
Okay. So after
right.
2 years, you things were starting to go well.
We thought it would work, yeah.
What made you think it would work?
We had begun to identify people who would be willing to support the program. But I think the other thing that happens is once you start something, it's pretty hard to actually shut it down.
Yeah, right.
But,
well, in a way, but you know, you really have definable goals. I mean, you had to raise the money. If you didn't raise the money, it was going to be very difficult to convince them to go much. So you had a stronger accountability than most folks, you know,
right.
who just kind of...
We had to raise some money. The money. We started small too,
mm-hmm.
and I give the committee and Marcel a lot of credit, and I give Martha and the foundation a lot of credit in the sense that we didn't try to support 20 students right away. We started by supporting 6 students per year for a few years, and then we would increase that number. But when I say we started. I mean, this is the first year. We had no donor base.
Mm-hmm.
We had nothing. We had an idea.
We had a table with 6 chairs or whatever, and people
we
sitting
had
around and talking
people
about
excited
it.
Excited
yeah.
about a concept
yeah.
and people
that's
who
a great
believed
story,
in it
yeah.
and wanted to make it
yeah.
work. But we didn't have a donor list. We had.
You said you started identifying donors. How did you go about identifying donors?
Well, we began to think about who might have an interest in this program. Okay, who'd want to support? So first, you're trying to figure out what is the program.
Mm-hmm,
so on
right.
one, so part of the day is spent thinking about what is it? What type of students are we trying to attract? What are the issues we're going to be dealing with? The other part of the day is who's going to support these students? And so we thought, businesses might have an interest in supporting
mm-hmm.
students. And at that time, we thought in part because of guilt. You know, they might want it. There are different motivations.
Oh, yeah,
you're right.
Right.
So one might be, well, that doesn't work anymore. But we also thought They want to hire people. I mean, if that's how you're beginning to think, companies want to hire more minorities.
Right.
But they want to hire minorities who are going to fit into their work environments and who are going to be strong students or graduates and all. So we're able to say to a business, this program will graduate, will educate and graduate students who you might want to hire, right? And you want to keep them right here in Wisconsin. So businesses. At the same time, we're thinking minority alumni. There aren't a lot, but minority alumni might want to support this program. So we're going through yearbooks looking for minority alumni.
Interesting.
We're talking to people who would give us names, and we talk to them, and they give us more names because there's no, we can't pull off of a database all minority alumni. In the 70s, the university does start to let students self-identify, but we don't
on
have...
On the admissions.
On admissions,
right,
but there's no way to identify
right.
who... And you know that the most recent grads aren't in a position to make...
Right.
...to really support the program. So go to Chicago, meet some people, they introduce us to other people, they tell us about their friends in New York, and we gradually began to build this list. And we worked with the Alumni Association on some of that, too. So here we are helping to build an alumni, a minority alumni database, and at the same time, we're working on the program and we're identifying people who might. It was great fun.
I bet it was.
I bet you
met a lot of networking, a lot of interest.
Oh, it was a lot. Yeah.
Did you find that you just got a lot of support from the people you were contacting? How did they respond to the idea?
Most of them were very supportive of the idea. They weren't necessarily, the individuals, the alumni, weren't necessarily in a position to make major gifts, but they were very supportive of what the university was attempting to do.
What about the faculty? Did you approach the UW-Madison faculty?
We talked to faculty as well. And we also solicited faculty again. We solicited them once, but we talked to a number of faculty. Of course, we talked to everyone on that committee, and everyone on that committee has made gifts early on and continue to make gifts. So, the faculty, staff, again, minority alumni as a potential donor base, and then other alumni who just wanted to see this happen, thought it was something that should happen.
Did Irv Shane or Bri Curl get involved at that point in any way for the fundraising aspect? Throwing their support behind the project?
They gave us their support. We could use their names. You have to understand, Irv Shane didn't like raising money, period. He'll tell you, he just didn't like it. I mean, that happened. Much of the Chancellor's role really changed after his tenure, you know, in terms of fundraising.
He was more like vice president for academic affairs.
Yes, he was.
His bailiwick, and I think he'd be very proud to say that his bailiwick was the campus.
That's right. Now, I mean, he'd do it.
Oh, yes,
he'd
I know that he
talk to
did,
people,
right.
He would sign letters, he would go to receptions, he would be very supportive, but he wasn't as active as Chancellor's. He was very supportive. I'm trying to figure out how. He was very supportive, but his role as a Chancellor going out there and talking to groups or audiences about the Chancellor Scholarship Program was very limited. One, we weren't doing a lot of that yet, and two, Irv didn't like to do that.
And three, at that point in time, I don't think the Chancellor's role was
as
defined. I'm talking about nationally.
Right.
Now, it would be inconceivable for you to start something like that without having a Chancellor going
there
helping you. But back then, that was not the case.
That's right.
And not that long ago, either.
No, and very supportive in making his own gifts. All of that. He did that too, and he would talk to people. And when he went on after the chancellorship to Olin, or to the company on the East Coast, not
that was,
Olin. It is
that
Olin.
Was Olin.
O-L-I-N.
That's O-L-I-N, right.
And he helped to facilitate gifts from the company too.
Oh, he got them too.
Right, and he would give us names of others who might have an interest, so he would assist in that way.
Yeah.
Either individuals or companies he thought might have an interest in this program.
Now, one of the interesting things you mentioned before we get off of this topic, you said you worked with the Wisconsin Alumni Association.
Mm-hmm.
that's another interesting story that's happening right about that time, because mm-hmm. I don't think the Alumni Association and the foundation really had that much to do with each other before that,
no.
did they?
No.
I mean, not because yeah. of any particular reason, just because they didn't.
No.
They were on separate tracks, kind of like.
Is that
accurate, or is that not?
No, it's accurate. They were on separate tracks. Their goal was to facilitate relationships with the university.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and we just did it in different ways. So
ours
was the
right.
fundraising mission.
Yeah, I'm just saying that yeah. you guys were just sort of had different missions.
Right.
And so you
right.
didn't have that. And that was one of the things that started happening about that is and Wharf too.
There were several things happening, and then we were probably out there looking for, then they, minority alumni, talking to them some, and then soon after that, I think they actually hired someone to work in this area, but I'm not sure how soon. I think, well, there was one person before Steve Brongen who heads up the Urban League, and, mm-hmm. and Steve worked in that, the diversity area at the Alumni Association, too. But we were hosting, we would go to alumni in Chicago and ask them to host events with us, and the Alumni Association would work with us on that, too.
So what happened essentially is you started cobbling together. Mm-hmm. I love that word. That's mm-hmm. a new word that's become very not a new word, but it's become very popular in the last few years. You started cobbling
yes.
together this base of donors taken
right.
with from businesses, from minorities, from faculty,
yeah.
from pretty much wherever you could
wherever
find.
Wherever we could find them.
Yeah.
And Marcille and I are going on the road talking to people and talking to businesses about what we're doing and what we're hoping to achieve.
Are you going separately, together?
Together,
yeah.
always together. And by the end of that first year, if we go back to the administrative side, because we haven't really gone out on the road by the early in that first year, we're still trying to put this program mm-hmm. together, and you need to know what you're doing
exactly,
before you go out there and start asking money.
Right.
So we're trying to identify potential donors, and at the same time we're putting the program together. And we thought, I think, in our initial timeline that would take us a couple of years. And then we accelerated the timeline, and by year two, we thought we were ready to recruit students, our first class.
What happened? What happened that made it that you could telescope it down mm-hmm. to 2 years?
I think we were successful in putting those, getting the criteria, putting the program together, and had enough money to support six students. And Marcille's always been very aggressive. You know,
right.
she wanted it
yeah.
to move, and she
right.
wanted it to move as quickly as possible. So we were able to agree that we would try to support six students starting year one, year two, and we will never have enough students for Marcille. She will
yes,
always
3,000 students. Well, we want 3,005.
Right. Exactly.
Did you were you and Marcille surprised at the level of the kind of response you were getting from the people you were talking to? Or is surprise the wrong word?
I don't think we were always hopeful. But the fundraising was slow. Initially it was quite slow.
Okay.
It was slow. But having said that, once you get that, you have enough to support the six, the application process was pretty slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think you have the pool of funds
yeah.
and there are all these students out there just waiting to apply, but you had to work to get
yeah.
the applicants too.
Yeah.
You had to really work to identify the people who could help us identify students and getting the information out to the high schools and getting the students to apply. So, not surprised by the interest, but it's not as if money just started flowing in.
You hear about the Kohl Center, Herb Kohl mm-hmm. gave what, $45 million or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And it's Granger mm-hmm. Hall, you had Granger,
right.
yeah, 25.
Yeah.
I don't know what that initial mm-hmm. big donor, I'm sure there's a word for that in the foundation business. Did you identify anybody who was a very significant donor in those early years, or was it really simply putting together what you could get?
We didn't have any major donors in those early years. It really was identifying people who were in positions to start, and our endowment levels were smaller too,
mm-hmm.
so people
right.
who might support an endowment, but
tuitions were cheaper.
Annual gifts,
right.
much of it was
yeah.
annual support.
And it takes a while to identify those truly major donors. Even, you know, if we talk about the Kohl Center, when we had basketball on our list initially as a need, we couldn't identify a donor.
That's
we took it off the list for our first campaign because we hadn't identified the donor.
Well, you also gave sort of a clue right there, by a key thing by saying annual gifts. So
largely,
it takes, in order to acquire, to build a base from annual gifts, it's going to take some annuals
sometimes
to happen. Yeah,
that's
it's
right.
Not going to happen in 1 year. It's going to take take a little bit. Was there any point in these early years, first couple of years, when you just said to yourself, I'm certain this is going to work? Or did you,
mm-hmm.
were you certain all along? What were your feelings?
Knew it would work, or thought it would work, had a strong feeling it would work. But I didn't know that we would be able, our initial goal, I think, was $3 million or something. But it was going to take a long time for us to get there. Then we changed the goal, and it was $10 million. And we're, I think if we look at all the funds, we're probably between around 8.5 right now. But the goal keeps...
Yeah, you're never gonna...
No. But it was, it, so it wasn't so much... I think people in development are real optimists, and we're going to hear no many more times than we hear yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you believe in what you're raising money for, you keep going out there and talking to people about it. And the goal is not just to ask them for money. The goal is to identify people who also believe in what you're hoping to accomplish, and they want to help you do it. They want to support it. And they feel good about it, too.
That's the... identifying those in the students.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about getting guidance counselors and whatnot in the state or in the Midwest involved?
A couple of ways. We identified the counselors in high schools in this area, high schools in Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, where we have large minority student populations.
Mm-hmm.
And the counselors in those schools, in some cases, we visited with them, or I visited with the counselors, or we talked to them on the phones. We worked with the admissions office, but making them aware of the program. We also had a brochure that first for that first class, an application brochure. So those were sent to the high schools, primarily those in-state, and then within a couple of years, I think we were sending them to some of the out-of-state high schools, too.
So basically, primarily, it was just within
primarily
Wisconsin
in-state
with this small number of students and everything.
Right,
you could do that.
Right. And then we also told alumni about the scholarship and asked us to help identify students, ask them to help us identify students who might qualify for the program. So the word went out that way. Applications came in. I don't remember how many. And then we selected the first group.
And was the selection committee pretty much that same committee that started with the oversight with Joe and you and Racine? And
I think that was, there were a few, Wally was definitely on that committee. Joe, I believe.
Joe Corey. Wally Dahl, normally.
Was Truman Lowe on that one? We wanted to make sure that the committee was ethnically diverse, too. And I served on that committee. Racine led that committee.
Was Tom Schick?
Tom Schick was on that committee, yes. I believe was Roger on that committee? So there were some differences. Martha, for instance, wasn't on that committee. She was more of the oversight committee.
I would suspect that Roger would represent the Dean of Students office.
And then Wally, the financial aid office. I'm pretty sure Roger was on that committee.
And then
so
admissions.
We have to go back to our notes. And then we had someone from admissions.
Jim Churchill, was he on that?
Jim Churchill was on it. Was he on the selection committee? And then from admissions, who was director of admissions? Anyway,
right.
I can see his face. And so that we went through that first round and trying to get a sense, you know, we were looking for leaders, students who had demonstrated leadership qualities, that their grades, their academic work in high school was strong, and what we were really looking for, did they have the potential to make it here at Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Really, that was very important. Well, it's key. The students had to write an essay. They had to submit letters of recommendation. And I don't remember, 25, I don't remember how many applications that first year. And then, but selected the 6 students, and it was very exciting.
I bet it was.
It was really exciting to have them on campus. And Marcille and I would, because I would make some of the calls in those early years, but calling students to offer them the scholarship and talking to the parents and talking to the students. And I miss some of that. I don't do that
anymore. Yeah, I'll bet that was exciting.
But yes, and you're offering this young person this opportunity, and it was great fun.
Did you bring the people in right afterwards or beforehand or?
No, we didn't actually meet them.
So it was all done
until the fall semester, right?
What was it like that first fall? That must have been very
incredibly exciting. Incredibly exciting because, I mean, they're nervous, but we have great hope.
Sure, you
but
are.
But you also know you have a lot riding on this.
You bet
class.
You do. Yeah.
You have a lot riding, and yet Ry Curl had said to Marcille, it's real important that you not put a lot of pressure on these students, that you figure out how to let them have a fairly normal student experience. And Marcille would talk about that. And no, you don't want them interviewed by a lot of people. And no, you don't want, because you have to be protective of them in a certain sense. So we're excited. They're excited, like any freshman is excited.
Mm-hmm, right.
But we began to lay the foundation for the program with that first class and began to understand what we wanted the student, how we wanted them to develop. If you think about the activities of that first group of students and what they did, I mean, we wanted them to bond with each other as well as others on campus. We wanted them to have the mentors, but we would have barbecues out in Marcille's backyard, and we would do the cooking, and that was their first sort of group experience.
So you were building a sense of community, is what
you were building. A sense of community, and trying to figure out how do you build a sense of community among these students who come from different parts of the state or the country, and you want them to feel a sense of community while here, but also after they leave.
How did you, once school started, did the students get together regularly with Marcille or with you or with both?
Yes. Before the semester started, they got together
for an initial meeting, an orientation
meeting. And then we had the fun piece of it, the picnic, which we continued. But we don't do the cooking anymore.
A little too big for that.
And they would meet with Marcille regularly, but now they're actually structured meetings, and I don't think those existed that first year. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had to meet, but it would be once or twice a semester, and then they had to see her regularly, individual appointments. But you know, now each class meets regularly. They meet once a month for fireside chat. So we added things over time that would both strengthen that sense of community, enhance that. But also, it was an attempt to encourage the qualities that we, or the expectations that we have, the qualities we have. For instance, the scholars are expected to do some volunteer work.
Mm-hmm. That was right from the get-go, you had to.
Not that, we didn't do that first year, but those are the types of things that became a part of the program over time.
What about the mentor program? When did that begin?
I want to say with that first, didn't we have mentors soon after that first class?
I would see how by the time you got bigger classes, you would almost need a mentor
because
you can't do it. She could mentor 6 people in her sleep, if I know Marcille.
We had mentors with the first class because Bri Curl was, I remember Bri mentored one of the students. Yes, we had mentors with the first group because that was part of the program initially, and we thought it was important for each student to have what we were calling, I don't know if we were calling them an adult friend at that time, but it's an adult friend on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who wouldn't talk about grades, not advising the students, but being a friend.
Perfect.
And yes, that we had
giving
mentors
advice
at the very beginning.
Like that, yeah.
And so we had to identify six people who would agree to serve as mentors.
Did you have trouble with that, getting them?
No.
And that's been pretty easy, because that continues with a lot more people.
Right.
And you...
I think, I don't know if it's still easy, I think the challenge is identifying the people, faculty, staff, who have both the time and the qualities you're seeking. And in most cases, it's worked out very well, but once in a while, you get a faculty, just doesn't, either the relationship doesn't click, or the time isn't there.
But also, I've looked over a list of the mentors over years, and my goodness, in some ways, it's like a who's who.
Right.
John Wiley was a mentor for many years before he rose to the...
And
bet he does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so many very...
Right.
Every
chancellor has served as a mentor.
Yeah.
So, it has every provost, because Irv Shane mentored a student, Brian Curl, Donna Shalala, they've all served as mentors.
Now, in this initial year, was the oversight committee active too, and were you evaluating your progress? How did you go about evaluating the success of the program,
the
or was it just gut feeling?
The first year, we're talking about the students and making sure they're doing okay, but there's not a, you know, the evaluation comes over, you'd have to allow a couple of years before you can really gauge the success of the program.
You said there was an initial oversight committee,
mm-hmm.
Implying that there was a later oversight committee. When did that change take place?
Initially, in the sense that the oversight committee was phased out. There is not an oversight committee today.
So, and there was a need for it initially.
I think initially we were trying to, I think when you're putting a program in place, it helps to have the several different perspectives and the thoughts of others rather than just one person putting it in place or two.
Did the students, this first group of students, did they understand that they were sort of
special
and that this was an important experiment and they were the ones who were going to help determine whether it was successful or not?
They understood to, I think, a certain extent. I don't know if they knew that the success and the future of the program rested on their shoulders, but they knew they were special and they knew that they were the first class and that we hope to have many more classes. Yeah. But, again, it's that balance between making them feel special but not pressuring them so much that they that it becomes a burden for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. There were some other things that began over the years. When did you start the newsletter?
Oh, I won't be able to give you dates for all
of them. I mean, that was something that came out later on?
Things that evolved over time, again, to make the program special, to really give them a different perspective on the university and the opportunity to take advantage of the minds on this campus. So we started Fireside Chats, and initially those weren't every month. I think they were once a semester, but then began to identify faculty who would enjoy speaking with students on a topic, their own research or their work. So every month now you have faculty speaking to the students and give the students an opportunity to interact with people other than their own mentors. The newsletter, and the students have a great deal of responsibility for that. Their ethnic fest or party where they share their various cultures with each other. The volunteer work that they do. What else are we? Some of them are mentoring or tutoring other students, and then they have the CSP buddies, and so a number of things have been added.
Now, buddies, is that you have buddies within the program?
Yes, and with younger people too. So you'll have to get that from Marcel.
Okay,
I'm not as involved.
I think she talked about some of that. One thing I did forget to ask, let me just go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't initially called the Chancellor Scholarship Program.
No.
You said at first it didn't really have a name, but didn't it have a name initially that was changed?
It had a name after that first year. We had a name, we didn't have a name before I came on board.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what we did that first year was to decide on what it would be called, and it was called we decided that both for development or fundraising activities and reasons, it made sense for the name to carry board to carry the title of the highest officer of the campus. We also thought it was important in terms of the students themselves. We thought about naming it for people, but if you name it for someone, people aren't necessarily going to give in honor of that
right.
person.
They might not even like that person.
Might not like that person, that's right. And so we thought chancellors make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also at that time a program called the Dean Scholarship Program
right.
in LNS.
Right.
And so that was the Dean Scholarship Program, and this was campus-wide. The Chancellor's Scholarship Program made sense. It was initially called the Chancellor's Achievement Scholarship Program. And after that first year, a decision was made to take Achievement out and just call it the Chancellor's Scholarship Program. And I think it was a good move. Some people still call it the Chancellor's Achievement Scholarship.
I've never heard it called that. That's interesting. The LNS Dean's Scholarship,
mm-hmm.
was that similar in terms of
very
merit?
Very similar.
Did it stay independent, or did you guys eventually merge?
It was an independent for a few years, and then eventually merged with the Chancellor Scholarship Program.
Okay. Okay. The first few years are finished. You have these small classes. Then there's a huge jump in the third year. Is that?
Yes.
What?
There's almost a doubling in that third year.
Yeah. Lay the groundwork for what you did to permit that to happen.
It was both more money and then the university's willingness to help support the program too. So we raised more money, but we're also university, and I'd have to check this, helped with some of the financial support. We were able to get buy-in from the deans, and in some cases deans were willing to help with support students. For instance, the Dean of Pharmacy helped to support students enrolling in pharmacy because it was great to have a Chancellor's
sure.
scholar in the pharmacy school. So trying to negotiate with the deans to help fund the scholar enrolled in their particular school or college. We need to do that again.
Did the It's on tape. Was there a climate on campus at that point? Was the climate changing more toward actively seeking minorities to attend UW, or did that get stronger as time went on, or had it been real strong when you came and just remained so, or how did
that? I think it was real strong when the program began. But the focus was on a different group of students.
Mm-hmm.
On the
need-based. Yeah.
And the support for the talent-based or the merit-based program grew
mm-hmm.
after the establishment of the scholarship. And I think it also grows because you're involving faculty as
right.
mentors, so you're
right.
getting buy-in that way.
People.
Right. They're reading about it in the campus newsletters. They're reading about it in the newspaper. We try to... whenever a class was selected, we tried to get that information out and include profiles on the students in the
mm-hmm.
campus newsletter. So just trying to publicize it as much as possible. And then fortunately, each chancellor took the program as his or hers.
Yeah.
And
that,
made it his or hers.
That's the beauty of naming it the chancellors,
right.
too. That was,
yes.
If it would have been the Herb Shane, David Ward would have still been interested in it,
but not as interested. Right.
That was brilliant. Let me just go back for just a little bit. Was it possible? Is it possible? Can you say that? Was it the right? Did this thing start at just the right time? Was the right person in the right time? Was it one of those things where Merceal and
the
times
right,
all came together?
Right person, right time. I mean, there's similar programs on other campuses too, but it was the right person. At the right time in Wisconsin's history. And you also had an administration willing to do something different.
Yeah.
So you had Irv Shane and you had Bri Curl being having listened to Merceal.
Mm-hmm.
They decided they were supportive of this idea and were willing to back it.
And we have to point out again, as anybody listening to this will understand, Merceal is just the key
She's
in this whole
key.
thing.
She's
the one
key.
who who gets all the spokes of the
That's
wheel
right.
out, shooting out there.
Without Mercille, you wouldn't have this program,
yeah.
and you wouldn't, and it wouldn't have the various components that it has today, and you wouldn't have had the buy-in from the administration, because it wasn't as if, let's go have a conversation, and we're going to start this program. They had to be convinced that it was the right time and the right thing to do.
I think I might have said this in Mercille's interview, but I sort of got flashback on when I was a kid. My favorite story that my mother would read to me was The Little Engine That Could.
Okay. Yes.
And that could sort of be almost Mercille. There's
yeah.
there is no hill or mountain or anything that's going to stop her from achieving what she wanted.
That's right. And once she got her hold, you know, she knew what she wanted to do, but once she could see the success and the potential, that's right, there was no stopping
yeah.
her. And each of the chances has had to, has benefited from that tenacity, but also, not so much been burdened by it, but had to deal with it.
Right, with Mercille.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, and that's what this program needs. You either voluntarily go along, or you surrender
right.
over time,
right.
because
exactly.
she's not
exactly.
going to stop. And anyone, listen to Mercille's interview if you doubt that. And we're saying this, of course, in the most positive
that's
light.
Right.
It's just her determination and sheer will that got
that's
this
right.
program off the ground and got it to grow. Now, after it started to increase and you got more students, was it at that point that you were hired on the foundation?
By year three, I'm no longer part-time.
Yeah.
50-50. By year three, I'm 100% foundation, and I begin to transition out of some of the activities I was involved in with the scholarship. So, and it doesn't all happen in year four or year
mm-hmm,
five,
mm-hmm.
but I assume other responsibilities at the foundation, and so I'm doing less. At one point, I stopped serving on the selection committee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now that they just reviewed 250 applications, it's only, you know. So I stopped serving on the selection committee, and over time was less involved with the administration of the program. Well, the upside is I could focus more on the development
mm-hmm.
and the fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is that Mercille loses administrative backup or support too, and so she's essentially been the program, as you said,
mm-hmm.
for years without a great deal of support. And,
so if so, go ahead.
And that's beginning to change. We'll go the other.
Oh,
way
okay.
Now.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that a little later on.
Mm-hmm.
So after you became full-time here, if Mercille had to go out and, let's say, do a fundraiser, she didn't go with Marion Brown, she went by herself.
Usually, no, she, because the fundraising...
Oh, the fundraising, you would still be involved.
I did the
yeah.
fundraising for the program, but I was working on behalf of some other program.
But if she was
well,
just trying to sell the program...
We
from
go together.
But if it wasn't a financial thing, if she was just going to talk to a group or something, she would not bring you along?
Whenever we did the groups or whenever we go on the road, usually we went together, even if it's to talk to a group of alumni in Chicago about getting applicants, that we do together. But if she's trying to figure out who's going to call up the professors to ask if Professor X will serve as a mentor, that's Mercille.
Yeah.
Who's going to go to the fireside chats, that's Mercille.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to call up the students and say, I need to see you, that's Mercille. So you have Mercille trying to meet with every student every semester, selecting the mentors, and that is not just
mm-hmm.
Barry Lee Service of Mentors calling you up, talking to you about the program, what's involved,
inviting you to come with the picnic, planning the picnic.
Once you're on board, the relationship's going okay, but you haven't seen your student in a while. Why haven't you seen? Is this, you know, so it's maintaining all that, all of the relationship, working with admissions to make sure the word is getting out. Admissions also shares with Mercille the names of prospective applicants, and they were involved from the very beginning of that, but making sure that you're getting those names from them.
So as you took on more foundation responsibilities, Mercille assumed more of those responsibilities, and you kept your fundraising
for
the Chancellor Scholarship
right.
Fund. But in a sense, while you gained more responsibilities in other areas and decreased your responsibilities with Mercil's program, you lost something too, didn't you?
Yeah, because I'm not as involved with the students. I used to know all of the students. I knew them by name. Mm-hmm. And now I don't, you know, I'm signing letters, thank you letters, acknowledgement letters. Right now, the annual fund, the telephone program is calling on behalf of the scholarship. Mm. So one, it's wonderful. There's a stack of thank you letters to sign. But I'm trying to remember, this name sounds familiar. Was this a scholar? Because you want to put a different note on that letter. So, but the other advantage is it means that other people here are working on behalf of the program now. In addition to my work, there are a couple of people and one in particular who's worked on behalf of the Chancellor Scholarship and travels much more with Mercil than I do. I don't travel with Mercil much at all anymore.
Do you miss that?
Yeah, I do. Huh. Yeah, I do. But he's on the road with Mercil every semester, and that's Pat Reedy. Mm. And he really has taken this program on, and he's the one who goes to companies with or without Mercil. He and another colleague have brought in some nice gifts for the program this year.
Now, what's Pat's background? I don't know much about
him. Pat is a development officer.
He started
here in corporate and foundation relations.
Okay.
And joined us about 10 years ago, I think. I'll introduce you to him when we're done. And he's just, he believes in the program, and he and Mercil make a fantastic team. They make a fantastic
team. I'd very much like to meet him.
Yeah, uh-huh. And Pat joined us at a time when he was at Mount Sinai before coming here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he brings a lot of support of the program to the table, but also maturity to the table and understanding of the Wisconsin community. He really knows Wisconsin well and knows the back roads, and he and Mercil also share another trait in common, that is they don't want to spend much money when they're on the road because they want every dime
scholarship. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a good place to stop today.
Okay,
it's just about time,
good.
And we'll pick up on it in our next session.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.